Father again, good afternoon. Welcome to today's meeting. My name is Paula Eat, Mayor of Kingborough. It's my pleasure to welcome you all to this meeting on Monday the 17th of November 2025. Welcome to those members of the community who are in the public gallery. The time being 5:30pm, I now officially declare the meeting open. Council now operates under the Local Government Meeting Procedures Regulations of 2025, and under these I am required to advise you that A, an audio or audiovisual recording is being made of the meeting, B, all persons attending the meeting are to be respectful of and considerate towards other persons attending the meeting, and C, language and conduct at the meeting that could be perceived as offensive, defamatory or threatening to a person attending the meeting or listening to the recording is not acceptable. The audio recording of council meetings is made publicly available on our website and meetings are now live streamed on YouTube. I now ask staff to confirm that the audio recording has started. Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reid, the Deputy Mayor, Councillor Gladewright, Councillor Antoli, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Dean, Councillor Fox, Councillor Richardson, and Councillor Street. From our staff this evening, we have the CEO, Mr. Stewart, Director of People and Finance, Mr. Spinks, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr. Smee, Director of Engineering Services, Mr. Mackey, Director of Environment Development and Community Services, Ms. Shakuti, our Communications Lead, Ms. Adams, and our Executive Assistant, Mrs. Morton. We have apologies this evening. We have an apology from Councillor Bain and an apology from Councillor Midgley. We're now on page one, confirmation of minutes. And the motion is that the minutes of the open session of Council Meeting number 19, held on the 3rd of November 2025, be confirmed as a true record. Looking for a mover. I've got a mover in Councillor Fox and a seconder in the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Workshops held since the last Council meeting. A workshop was held on the 10th of November in relation to risk. Declarations of interest. Does any councillor have an interest they wish to declare? No, thank you. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item on the agenda that a councillor would like to transfer from open into closed session or closed into open? No, thank you. Questions without notice in the public. Does any member of the public wish to ask a question without notice? If so, please come to the lectern. Mark, would you just mind having a look that that is on? Because mine wasn't turned on. Got a green light? Thank you. Good evening.
Good evening. Charlie Biggins, Leslie Barr. 2026 is election year for local councils. Councillors are requested to sign a candidate's pledge of support to the Australian Services Union before coming to office. What role does the Australian Services Union play in the day-to-day governance of Kingborough Council?
The CEO.
Through you, Mayor. So the Australian Services Union doesn't play a direct role in the governance of the organisation. We have a enterprise agreement with the union that governs some of the conditions through which we employ staff in the organisation.
In 2018, former Mayor Dean Winter was the subject of a code of conduct complaint by a member of the public following his public criticism of council's enforcement officers relating to dog control. The former Mayor was also disciplined by the Labor Party as a direct result of his criticism of council staff actions. Was the Australian Services Union involved in either the Code of Conduct complaint or the disciplinary action taken by the Tasmanian Labor Party?
The CEO.
I'm not aware of the nature of that Code of Conduct complaint or who was involved or party to it.
Would you like to take that question on notice then?
We can take that question on notice.
Thank you.
As per any of information that's available in the public realm.
Thank you very much.
Could I just add to that? I might suggest, because we wouldn't be able to find out that information about what occurred within the Labor Party, so you'd best direct that part of the question to the State Labor Secretary.
So we don't have any Labor Party members in the room at the moment in the council?
Well, you're asking about an administrative process of a political party, and not all members of political parties would be aware of administrative processes, and certainly not back to 2018. So that part of the question would be best directed to the State Secretary of the Labor Party.
It was a highly publicised, and it's all through the media. So, question three, is it correct that council is currently getting assistance from other council planning departments to complete their development applications, development application responsibilities? And is there currently any industrial action arising from Kingborough's planning department regarding work health safety complaints directed at the organisation of council?
The CEO.
I have written to other councils to see if they have any available capacity that they would be able to second into council to be able to provide some additional resourcing for Kingborough due to workforce demands within our planning area. In regard to industrial action, there's no industrial action that council is currently in relation to your question.
Thank you very much.
Are there further questions? Please come to the lectern. And just your name and the suburb in which you reside, please, before you begin.
Hello, my name is Janet DeHoog, DEHOOG. I'm from Lower Snug. I asked this question at the last council meeting and it was taken on notice, so that's the 3rd of November, and it was not mentioned or addressed in any way in this agenda, so I'm just going to ask it again. We currently cut dead trees and limbs on our 10-hectare property for firewood for our wood heater. It keeps us warm. It reduces the fire load for bushfires. At a recent TPC hearing, one of the Kingborough planners said that under the environmental living, owners can apply to council to be able to cut firewood for their personal use on their private property. My question is if our property is changed to LCZ, we will be able to continue to cut down trees on our property to use as wood for our home's wood heater.
I'll ask the CEO to address that because I can see a response here on page 4-5 of the agenda.
Couldn't see it.
Thanks, Mayor. So I think that question related to another question that was asked last week that was
the
taken
third
on
question.
Notice.
Yep. Right.
So our Director of Environment, Development and Community will address the piece that we missed. And apologies for that. That was an oversight from our end.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Yes,
apologies for missing
that
part of the question. Down. Right.
Can you hear me now?
Yes. Closer. Okay. Is that better? Okay. So if you have an existing approval to remove firewood on your property, that will remain. Moving forward, regardless of zoning, you can apply to remove firewood on your land under the scheme. And I suppose the other thing too is the normal exemptions under vegetation clearing exemptions apply to all zones under the future scheme.
Okay, so like we could, if we had approval, we'd need to apply for approval.
If you have existing approval to do that, which you would need in all zones under the current interim scheme, then you can continue to do that, yes.
Thank you.
Any further questions, please come to the lectern.
Good evening. Tamika Adkins from Oyster Cove. Did Kim Kimber Council rely primarily on aerial mapping and desktop GIS modelling without site verification or public consultation to determine the landscape values that underpin the local provision schedule nominations?
Ms Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor. My understanding is that it's been a hybrid. A lot of our overlays, particularly around vegetation, but other features are done by looking at GIS or satellite imagery. That's common across many organisations and councils to look at landscape values that way. We also have a lot of, ground-truthed data that's available to us over the years of having many, many surveys completed for various different reasons and to use that. So I couldn't categorically say that it is one or the other. I believe it's a hybrid of both.
Believe? You don't know?
It is a hybrid of both.
Okay. Aerial imagery provides a scientific baseline, but it must be supported by ground truthing and participatory mapping to capture how people value and interact with the landscape. So you may think you have already answered this, but were on-site inspections or field validations undertaken for all properties to confirm the findings from aerial mapping before finalising the LCZ boundaries?
Ms Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor. No, it was not.
Without field validation, LCZ boundaries may not be evidence-based in accordance with best practice landscape assessment methodology. How can Council ensure that the mapped landscape values accurately represent both the physical landscape and the community's relationship with it?
Ms Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor. I suppose I would like to say we are undertaking a review of this, as you are likely aware, and so answering these questions ahead of that review is perhaps preempting an outcome. We are, as part of this review, looking at the methodology and ensuring that that methodology is robust and consistent. What I would say generally, though, is you know, for organisations that have to undertake broad-scale mapping of different values, it is quite common for not 100% of it to be ground-truthed. There are some practical limitations in being able to do that.
Yes, I can agree with not 100%, but perhaps not maybe 5% either. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further questions, please come to the lectern.
Nicholas Booth from Longley.
Good evening.
Good evening. Can the council explain the scope of work or terms of reference for the consultation in relation to the consultation that's going to be done for the LCZ?
Ms Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor. The review scope of works has been developed in accordance with Direction 69 from the Commission. That direction did not request council to specifically undertake consultation. However, we are very well aware that our community has a lot of concerns. So we are in the process of approaching or writing to the Commission to ask what we can and can't do as part of that review in terms of consultation.
Council also advised on what terms and conditions and remuneration for the consultants will be and whether the work will be tendered out if it's over $250,000.
Ms Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor. The terms and conditions are quite detailed, so I'm not in a position to be able to tell you those in detail. I can give you an overview in that the scope of works is to undertake the review as per Direction 69 of the application of LCZ in Kingborough in accordance with the Section 8A guidelines, any relevant strategies and policies, and information and submissions presented at the hearings to date. Then additionally to that, a review of the Bruny Island SAP and the Bonnet Hill SAP, and I suppose, the views of elected members as well. In terms of the process, we have sought advice from our finance team and procurement team to ensure that the procurement is in line with our policies, and we believe we've actually gone sort of beyond what is required for the estimated value. Yes, if it was to be over the $250,000 mark, it would absolutely be in accordance with the policies and procedures for procurement.
Is that likely to happen?
Ms. Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor, I don't believe it's likely.
Given the current housing crisis, can the Council explain how the Council is doing more to speed up the current planning process rather than the apparent bottleneck that's been created by the Planning Department in its current state?
Ms. Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor, as you're aware, we comply with our statutory timeframes for assessment processes. Of course, we do want to be improving on that when we can be, and not waiting until the statutory timeframe, you know, right till the end. As I suppose previously alluded to by the CEO, we do have some resourcing constraints at the moment, so it is a little bit difficult for us to be making those improvements with those constraints, and the staff are working very hard to keep on top of their workloads. However, moving forward, as part of our continuous improvement program, all areas of our organisation will have initiatives identified for efficiencies, and our planning and development services department will be a team that hopefully we are focusing on as a priority.
Given that you, Kingborough Council don't actually publish your timeframes, how do we have a benchmark?
Ms. Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor, they are actually published. Admittedly, they are a little difficult to find if you don't know what you're looking for. So under the list data, there is a database called the CDC database, in which councils report all sorts of metrics through, and they are published on the list website. If you would like information about that, we can provide where to find that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Further questions?
Richard Woolley, Lower Snug. In the letter that was distributed recently regarding the consultant that's to be employed to assess the landscape conservation zone, it states that there will be input from council staff. I was under the understanding that the consultant would be employed to remove the input from the council staff and oversee the project. So I'm just wondering how much input the planning staff, the existing planning staff, will have with the new consultant when and if he or she's employed.
Thank you for the question. Ms. Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor, I think it's very reasonable that our staff have some input in terms of being able to brief the consultant once engaged, provide an overview of methodology used, as well as providing information about hearings to date and what the responses have been. So for this review to be done properly, staff will need to engage or liaise with the selected consultant to be able to provide them enough information to do the review.
So on that, who will oversee the independence of the consultant to ensure that the staff don't have the overriding input with the consultant, and it's we're back where we started.
Ms. Shakuti.
Through you, Mayor, the project is being overseen by the CEO and myself. Consultants as well have professional standards in terms of independence, and will use those professional standards and processes to ensure they are providing an independent opinion and recommendations.
So with that, we can guarantee the process will be completely independent and overseen by staff, senior staff.
Ms. Chiquiti.
Through you, Mayor, yes, and we have actually developed an internal governance process for this project to ensure that happens.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? If so, please come forward.
Karen Groves from SNUG. As witnessed in the Huon Valley LPS process, titles proposed for the LCZ that weren't included in a representation were still moved to the landscape conservation zone. If Kingborough's consultant does not recommend moving all proposed LCZ titles, including those that missed out on a representation, into the preferred rural living zone by default, the suggestion implicitly given in Direction 69, what responsibility will council take to ensure an injustice does not occur for those families?
CEO.
So the scope of works for the consultant is to consider primarily in the first instance anyway, the properties that were proposed originally to go through into the PPZ, and also all properties that were zoned landscape conservation. So there is not a scenario where a property is not considered through this process. All properties that are proposed at this stage to move to landscape conservation will be part of the consideration through the consultant. Secondarily, the implication of moving to the zone is that it's a change of zone, right? It's not a fundamental change to the nature of the property, so therefore council has no, I guess, direct obligation to those property owners in the case that the commission at the end of the process sees fit for a property to be zoned landscape conservation.
I think Ms. Chiquiti would like to add something.
Yep.
Thank you, through you, Mayor. The commission, after receiving the review from the consultant and considering it, will then determine consultation with affected landowners as well. So they will determine what they think is appropriate in terms of contacting landowners after that process is finalised.
You've stated that the LPS consultant will be reconsidering the application of the LCZ, and our Direction 69 asks that you consider the Sterlis Addendum SRD 1.3, supporting the consolidation and recognition of existing rural and environmental living communities by applying the rural living zone. What other options will Kingborough be considering for those proposed for the LCZ, if not the rural living zone? And if there are no other options, why do we need a consultant to do this?
Ms. Chiquiti.
Through you, Mayor. That question's probably too difficult to answer because the review will determine that in terms of what the options are in accordance with each zone, the guidelines and how to apply the zone, Stralis, etc. So that will be for the review to determine.
And final question?
Yeah. In the LPS approval process, once hearings are complete, the TPC considers all evidence and decides if changes are needed to the draft. If the TPC decides that the draft LPS requires a substantial modification, the Planning Authority submits a new part of the draft LPS to the TPC, and then it will go back to exhibition. Would you consider that moving all current ELZ or LCZ titles to the RLZ constitutes a substantial modification?
Ms. Chiquiti.
Through you, Mayor, I'm not in a position to be able to answer that. That would be a question for the Planning Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, please come forward.
Harry Hale, from Pearson's Point. Members of council probably aren't aware. Our family, in subdividing some of our farm, were having to give over some land as public open space. And one of those was the Pearson's Point Reserve, on which there's a tennis court, and council has spent a little bit of money on putting a new top on it, and they put a new net. It is a very popular court. A lot of people are seen out there utilising it. I'm wondering... And at the moment, the net needs some attention, and I'm wondering whether the council would see their way clear to do something about doing some repairs to that. Number two, also on Pearson's Point, there's a fortification there which is very historic, and there's a very large gum tree growing right next door to it and causing a lot of damage to that fortification. What needs to happen is the tree needs to be demolished and got rid of, and in return of that happening, obviously there'd have to be some more trees planted to make up for it. Would council consider that? Because something needs to be done about it. Third thing, council has thankfully and appreciated by the public put in a gas barbecue which is run free at a cost to the council at Tinderbox. And it would be nice to see a similar thing done at Pearson's Point. Would the council consider that for the future? Thank you.
Thank you for the questions. I'll ask Mr. Smee to assist us with those, please.
In relation to the tennis court net, we can certainly have a look at the condition of that and whether that needs... fixing or replacement. The tree in the reserve would need to be assessed in accordance with its condition and natural values, and the question of a barbecue shelter would be one for our capital bid process for future budget consideration, but we can certainly add that to the mix.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Thank you. Please come to the lectern.
Ted Hale, Tinderbox Road, Tinderbox. At the last council meeting, I raised some issues of safety along Tinderbox Road. Some further issues I would like to raise. A few weeks ago, there was an incident where a car went over the bank and caught fire. I don't know any further details as to what happened with that, other than to know that it's in a very precarious position. The bend in the road just prior to where that, just north of where that car went over, has been is a very dangerous corner. The bitumen pavement goes virtually right to the edge of the bank, so if any car just errs a little bit going around that corner, they can be going off the side. Downhill, there is a house below it, and it's an I For a long time, it's been an urgent need to actually have barrier fencing around that corner. The question is, Council prepared to look at what is required there? There's a further safety issue further south from that point where the road is suffering from probably recent weather in particular, but there's subsidence on the lower side of the road and that is heading towards actually giving way and sliding down into the valley next to it. And I would suggest that remedial action to arrest that before it actually happens would be a good move. And then the third one, which I also raised last meeting, was to do with overhanging trees. And just to add to that, last week on the highway just near Alford, a friend of ours came round a corner doing 90 kilometres per hour on that road and was confronted with a tree actually in the process of falling. He was unable to avoid it. He crashed into it and his car was demolished. He fortunately got out of it. But I think that, again, red flags the need for attention to trees, not just on Tinderbox Road, on all roads, but Tinderbox Road is particularly dangerous the way it is at the moment.
Thank you. Mr Mackey, would you like to speak to that, please?
Through you, Mayor. As per our response, would like to understand the particular areas, the actual site specific. We did have one of our council officers go and drive that. We didn't identify any limbs that posed a hazard. They all seemed to be healthy, but if you know or can direct us to exactly where you have concerns. Regarding the corner, we can get our roads engineer to have a look at the sight lines and the bitumen and pavement width at that section. The other one is also, it would be good if we could have a specific location regarding, was it the substance on the side of the road with a risk of, is it landslip onto the road?
Yeah.
Yep. But we can do that, but if you can help us with some specific locations. If you can,
I'll have to get numbers for you.
Yep. Yep, that would be good. And if you can send them through to the email, that would be appreciated.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? No. Thank you very much for your questions. We now move to page 2, questions on notice from the public. If you wish to submit a question on notice, you can do so by completing the relevant form on our website or by emailing kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. We had questions, the first one on zone and code overlays from Mr. Lemench, sorry if I unfortunately pronounced that incorrectly, with a response from Mr. Stander. The second one in relation to residential development in the LCZ from Professor Rowan and a response from Mr. Stander. Another one from Professor Rowan with a response from Nikki Den-Exter in relation to bushfire risk management. A question from Ms. Groves with a response from Mr. Stander in relation to the draft LPS. A question from Ms. De Hoog and an officer's response from Ms. Den-Exter in relation to reduction of bushfire risk under LCZ. A question from Ms. Atkins and a response from Mr. Stander in relation to LCZ overlays. Further question from Ms. Atkins and a response from Mr. Stander in relation to definition of landscape values. And a final one from Ms. Atkins with a response from Mr. Stander in relation to minimum lot sizes. Last two questions, one from Mr. Hale with a response from Mr. Mackey in relation to trees and overhanging branches. And finally, a question from Mr. Redeker with a response from Ms. Shakuti in relation to the consultant. Takes us to page 9, questions without notice and councillors. Does any councillor wish to ask a question without notice? I've got the Deputy Mayor and then Councillor Antoli. Deputy Mayor and then Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. My questions are for the Director of Environment Development and Community. And they're related to the draft local provision schedule. I note that there are many codes and overlays. Some of these include the Natural Assets Code, the Scenic Protection Code, codes for bushfire, landslide and erosion, waterway and coastal protection overlays, and overlays for vegetation and biodiversity. So my question is, given the zone purpose of the rural living zone provides for residential use or development in a rural setting where existing natural and landscape values are to be retained, and given there are several codes and overlays which provide environmental controls, what is being protected in the rural living zone which is not being protected in, which is being protected in the landscape conservation zone?
Ms. Shikuti. Through you, Mayor. Thank you. That's a very complex question. And you're right, many codes apply across our municipality and often multiple on a particular property. So each property is different in terms of what is being protected and what is not. So some properties may not have any of those codes applying. Some may have two, three or more, depending on the features of the land. What is being protected is outlined in the zone, its purpose itself, landscape conservation. So it is the landscape values that is not specifically referenced in the other zones, or the natural values overlay.
Yeah, so rural living does actually talk about existing natural and landscape values. Next question. If we propose that more of our environmental living zones shift to rural living zone, given rural living zone D provides for minimum lot sizes of 10 hectares, why would overdevelopment be a concern?
Ms. Shikuti. Through you, Mayor, and I would just like to provide some clarification to the previous question. It's around the extent and significance of those landscape values in terms of the zoning and what its purpose is to protect. The difference between the zoning for landscape conservation value, landscape conservation zone and rural living zone is different. Rural living D is 10 hectares, but there is rural living A, B and C. So 1 hectare, 2 hectare and 5 hectares. So it would then depend on which zone is applied, so which subcategory is applied. So, for example, you know, the logical conclusion is that if, for example, rural living A is applied, well then the potential subdivision lot size is much smaller, therefore it would be quite different. In terms of your point around rural living D, that is still a smaller size than landscape conservation zone. I'm not saying either is right or wrong, but that just is the difference between the lot sizes. And when there is greater subdivision potential, then you will have increased densification in a particular area, potentially. And, you know, if for example, people are putting a dwelling on that, there is a level of clearing that needs to occur, not just for the dwelling itself, but also for the bushfire management area, which would apply generally to most of our municipality. So there is a difference in terms of the impacts or potential impacts that applying rural living versus landscape conservation zone has. Again, it depends on the suitability of that particular area and property as to whether it's categorised to landscape conservation or rural living.
What are the environmental controls that are deemed necessary to be included in specific area plans that are not provided for in codes and overlays?
Ms. Shikuti. Through you, Mayor, The specific controls, and this is difficult for me to answer on the spot without the particular wording of each SAP in before me. Some of those areas do have increased or not, they're not just rural living zone or landscape conservation zone, there are other zoning in those areas, and those particular SAPs have local values or landscape values that it is being proposed, but again, particularly the Bonnet Hill and the Bruny Island SAP is being reviewed, so I don't want to talk with, I suppose, certainty about the outcomes of that. However, there are particular landscape values in some of those SAP areas, or all of those SAP areas, that may not be protected due to that other zoning that applies that is not rural living or landscape conservation.
The Deputy Mayor.
Thank you.
Next I had Councillor Antoli, then I've got Councillor Richardson and then Councillor Cordova. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I've got three questions that have been triggered by questions that were brought forward by members of the gallery, which is great because it gives me a chance for clarification. There was a question by Mr. Biggins around the ASU statement, and he mentioned that candidates are required to sign it. Could you clarify if it's required or requested that candidates sign?
It's requested.
Thank you. So it's not required?
No.
Great. Thank you. The second question is regarding the whole consultant process for the LPS. Mr. Woolley was asking questions about independence of the consultant from planning staff, and I think that was relatively well answered. But are the planning staff, is that process going to be led by the consultant or advised by the consultant? Who is the lead and who's in charge and who's answering to whom?
Ms. Shakuti or the CEO? I don't mind. Take your pick.
How about I try and answer that one? So the process is procured by council, so council owns the process. However, the consultant is being, I guess, contracted to lead a review of that process. As part of that, there is an expectation that that consultant will be relying upon and having inputs from all the information gathered thus far through the process and the insights about what has happened so far. So there's a lot of information that would be lost if staff were not involved in that process in any way, so the expectation is that they are. In terms of the accountability behind that, ultimately that sits with me around making sure that that's a fair, unbiased process and that we're delivering the best possible outcome at the back end of it.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. And if the CEO could maybe help the community know and understand the oversight that the Planning Authority has with regards to your interaction with the consultant, if you could give some clarity to the community, maybe some comfort to the community that it's actually the Planning Authority that is overseeing the process, delegating to yourself.
CEO.
Thanks, Mayor. Through the process and through the notice of motion that came and the consequential resolution of Council, ultimately that report is produced and will come back to Council for its approval before it goes back to the Tasmanian Planning Commission. So that is something that is done through me in order to enact that resolution of Council. But you're right, the Council and acting as the Planning Authority ultimately has the oversight that it'll come back through this group for approval before it goes back to the Planning Commission.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. And that leads me to my third question, which is with regards to if maybe you could update the community on where we're at with the whole process, the tendering, the consultant, who's been chosen, if anybody, and how is the process of choosing the finalised consultant? How is the Planning Authority involved in the choice, or is it you that's just making the choice on your own?
The CEO.
So the tender process closes today. So we haven't got a preferred contractor at that point, but we are in receipt of applications to that process, tenders to that process. From there, there'll be a panel produced, which will then assess the validity of those applications using both price and non-price attributes to consider the relative merits of the tenders that we've received. From that point, we'll produce a memo with recommendation that'll be sent to councillors as the planning authority to review all the materials received and the recommendation, and then ultimately following on from that point, we will appoint a contractor to it. The reason that we have done it that way is because of timing. Ultimately, we want to be able to appoint this role as fast as possible. So we will do that in an offline process at this point. If there are concerns from councillors about that, we will look at a more formal mechanism to convene council in order to discuss and appoint that contractor.
Councillor Antolli.
Thank you, Mayor. I think those questions help clarify that it's actually the planning authority that's the final decision maker and not the CEO or any of his staff, but we're delegating him to do it because we've got day jobs. So we appreciate the effort he's putting into it. That's all the questions from me.
Thank you. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Question for the CEO. Last meeting, Councillor Antolli followed up on a previous question from Dean.
That's better. Just talk a little louder. It wasn't kicking in on the microphone.
Okay. Did you get all that?
Yep.
Do you want to start again?
No, you better start again.
Okay. So I think last meeting, Councillor Antolli followed up on a question from Councillor Dean relating to us writing, or the council writing to the TPC and advocating for allowance of late submissions for people who did not know that their property was going to be zoned to LCZ, and just wanted to follow up, has that happened as yet?
CEO.
Yes, a letter has been sent to the TPC. I've also had informal conversations with them about the fact that this was coming to make sure that they were ready to respond. So I would expect a response to come back from them sometime soon.
Councillor Richardson.
Okay, and in those informal conversations, was there any indication on which way that might go?
The CEO.
So there was no direct indication of the response. I guess there are various things at play. Obviously, there's the council response to the Direction 69 that we've received and understanding the context of the work that has been done there. Additionally, that there were directions issued to third parties that submitted a number of representations on behalf of other property owners, and there is work being done around, I guess, the response of those property owners to the to those representations provided by a third party. So there's some complexity in that, which they indicated, but they didn't give me a steer of exactly what the response would say.
Councillor Richardson.
And what is the intended process that will follow once we receive the reply to that letter? How will we publicise its contents?
The CEO.
So in the first instance, the Tasmanian Planning Commission will probably, my understanding is, would publish the letter that they have received from me and would publish the response that they send back to me. So it'll be publicly available in that way. Additionally, depending on the outcome of it, there might be actions that then become incumbent on council in order to enact whatever the response is. So they're... The answer is it depends a little bit on what the information is, but my understanding is that information will be published on the Tasmanian Planning Commission website.
Councillor Richardson.
Okay. Would it be fair to assume that regardless of the outcome, we will find some way to communicate that to the public?
The CEO.
Yes, acknowledging that that it's not our decision around supplementary public consultation on the process at this stage, and the previous indications from the Commission had been that the exhibition period was closed. There weren't further representations that were being accepted at this stage. If there was a change from that status quo, we would absolutely be communicating that to the community.
Councillor Richardson.
That's all. Thank you.
Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. My question, Mayor, through you, is about feral cat management. I seek to understand if Council is in a position to increase the scale and scope of our feral cat trapping operations to the extent necessary to make a meaningful impact in reducing the feral cat population in Kingborough. Anecdotally, there's just so many more sightings of feral cats now, particularly in our rural and regional areas. It's obviously acknowledged that community participation is essential to the program's success for Council's cat management efforts. And I know that residents can report sightings and provide access to private property for trap placement. So my question is, if members of the community are willing to have their private property used for cat trapping purposes, is there like an online form on our website, or is that something that we're doing call outs to the community to ask them to offer their land for cat trapping? Or are we at a point in terms of capacity where if 1,000 people say, yeah, you can come and trap on my private land, like, are we in a position to accommodate those requests?
Ms. Chaputi.
Through you, Mayor, I'm not actually sure of the answer to that in terms of our capacity. We obviously have limited resourcing across our organisation for various risks and threats, particularly in our natural areas team, and we are having to balance managing different values, risks and threats at any one time. We do have a robust cat management program, and a lot of work has been put into education, awareness, trapping, working with other agencies on that. So I would have to consult with the team as to whether we put that type of initiative in place, as to whether we could manage that or not. So we'll have to take that on notice, I think.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you for that answer. And through you, Mayor, I guess my follow-up open-ended question is, it would help strategically from a kind of councillor perspective to have the knowledge about what threshold of feral cat trapping is actually meaningful. So if we're just taking out 16 cats at a time when, you know, I can walk around Allen's Rivulet and I could probably find 16 cats, feral cats, running around Allen's Rivulet, how meaningful is the cat trapping that we're currently undertaking, and what are the benchmarks that we're trying to achieve to make a like, obviously on Bruny Island, trapping 16 cats is material. You know, that does make a big difference. So I guess just having a bit more information around what counts as success for our cat trapping program would be really interesting to me.
Ms. Chaputi, any further comment?
Through you, Mayor, I agree that would be good information to have. I would say some of the biggest impact we have is through education and awareness of responsible cat ownership as well.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Just one question. One question for me. Last year, Council formed an aquatic facilities steering committee, and as part of the work that they've done in support of staff at the end of last year, applied for a federal grant to help us to further explore the possibility of a pool or an aquatic facility. It's coming up to a year, and given the fact that we were hoping for a response, either yay or nay, in the first half of the year, given it coming up to a year, I was wondering, Mayor, whether you or the CEO might, just on behalf of committee, write to the Minister for an update so that we might be able to progress with our work. I note today there was a press release with the Minister and our local member, Julie Collins, that $4.8 million have been given to Clarence and Hobart City for consultation and design work for two other projects, yet we seem for a far less amount have been bypass. So a formal update would be fantastic.
Yep, happy to do that.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you very much. Lost my place where we were up to. Sorry, bear with me. We are on questions on notice from councillors on page 9. We had one from Councillor Antoli in relation to use of 1080 poison with a response from Ms Quinn, and a question in relation to the LPS consultant from Councillor Midgley with a response from Ms Shakuti. Takes us to the following page, page 10, petition still being actioned. A report on the petition headed installation of footpaths and upgrades on Cleburne Street, Kingston, will be provided at a future meeting. And at the time the agenda was compiled, no petitions had been received. Takes us to page 11, officers' reports to council. The first one is the local government amendment targeted reform bill 2025 with recommendation on page 13. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Got a mover in the Deputy Mayor and a seconder, Councillor Cordova. Deputy Mayor.
Thank you. The Tasmanian Government has released for public consultation the Local Government Amendment Targeted Reform Bill 2025. This is the second phase of the consultation. Council considered the discussion paper at a workshop back in February and provided feedback. The proposed changes will be implemented as amendments into the Local Government Act 1993. The proposed reforms are on the whole supported as outlined in the report, and I commend the motion.
Thank you. Further discussion? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I am happy to support this. I do have a question around the recent government questions, surveys around councillor numbers. How is that connected, or if not, to this bill? Is this bill a precedent to making that second option happening, or are they totally separate discussions?
No, they're totally separate. So they had, I think there's a suite of three bills in total. This is the first one that is going in, and then the others will follow early next year. I believe it was in the March 2025 session that the one would go in relation to councillor numbers. But this one has been, this has got, I guess, a large chunk, if you like, of recommendations that flowed from the local government review that was undertaken over several years. So this is really the first stage of that that's got to legislative change. Councillor Antoli.
Thank you. Are you aware when the government plans to then table this particular bill?
My understanding that this will be tabled in March next year as well. It's too late for the, given that the consultation draft is only out now. Consultation is closing today. It's my understanding for March 2025. Thank you. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. So I'm supportive of taking this next step, and I just had a question around what discussion, and I'm thinking now specifically around section 28ZR, so serious councillor misconduct provisions, what's been the discussion around the defining the concept of serious, I guess the definition of serious, and my particular interest is around what's currently under Part 3, use of office, the actions of a councillor must not bring the council or the office of councillor into disrepute. My particular interest, just to try and make clear what my question is that there's a role that councillors play that's quite obvious in directing the strategic direction of the organisation up to and including making comment on the CEO's performance. But I'm really interested in the interaction between, like right now I've seen in councils here and elsewhere, where when councillors talk about staff, that can have a real impact on staff. It can have an impact on the organisation and the reputation of the organisation. So I'm interested to know what counts as serious misconduct under the new provisions with respect to bringing the organisation into disrepute, and is there a definition of that?
So the consultation paper that was released talked about a range of figures. I think it was about about eight different matters that would constitute serious misconduct. And factors that they deemed to consider would be whether it's unlawful, the extent of any actual or potential harm or risk caused by the conduct to an individual, the council or to public safety, the degree to which the conduct negatively impacts on the ability of council to perform its functions, whether the conduct involves deliberate and intentional misuse of council resources, information, etc., for personal gain, nature and extent of any material benefit or detriment caused by the councillor or others as a result of it, whether it's part of a repeated pattern of behaviour, such other public interests, and then there's proposed a catch-all which says that such other matters or considerations that are can be specified by the minister in any guidelines that they issue. So, and all of that will be can be appealed at TASCAT, I understand. That has arisen out of a number of high-profile cases where councillors, not in, in this council, but in other parts of Tasmania, have been convicted of criminal offences, and but the minister had no power to remove them from council. So there was pretty significant feedback that those sorts of things were appropriate. The other part of your question really relates to the workplace health and safety obligations, and certainly, and I'm just trying to find the relevant section in the discussion paper, because there's certainly a desire to ensure that councillors are aware of their obligations under the Workplace Health and Safety Act to have a safe workplace in terms of not only, of course, physical safety but psychosocial safety as well, for each other as councillors but also for our council staff. And you'd be aware we've had several workshops in relation to that, and that continues to be an issue that that the Local Government Association receives feedback from both mayors and councillors on a regular basis. So there's some work within this in relation to that as well.
Thank you. And to finish off my contribution, the reason why I'm so interested in this is that, well, I'd actually like to ask a follow-up question, if I may, which is that is it the opinion of this council that this proposed amendment or this bill will actually strengthen the provisions such that councillors will have to be more careful in future about damaging the reputation of council by publicly admonishing staff when that's not their role? Is that the opinion of this council, that this new bill will actually strengthen those provisions?
Look, certainly my understanding of the provisions of this legislation is that that's the intention by the government to do that, is to ensure that there are, that it is a safe working environment for everybody involved, and certainly some of these provisions do target those particular areas where perhaps the Local Government Act in the past has been either silent or not strong enough. So I would expect on paper that that is the intent. I guess it follows then on the implementation once the legislation is enacted as to whether that is the impact that it does have.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. The balance that we're obviously trying to strike here, I think, is that obviously it's incumbent on the councillors to try and strive for excellence and to try and make sure that the organisation is striving for excellence. And that obviously includes having, you know, frank and fearless discussions around the performance and operations of the CEO. But, the Local Government Act is quite clear that in the discharge of their duties, you know, councillors shouldn't be directing staff members on operational matters. That's the role of the CEO, and it's the councillor's role to direct the CEO in those strategic matters. And for me, I'm kind of thinking of this in terms of councillors are like a board of directors with some very clear differences, one being that we're elected by the community as opposed to, you know, in a commercial or a corporate context. We have a... Can you imagine if a board of directors was running around undermining their own staff or speaking badly about their own staff in public discourse? That would clearly undermine the reputation of that organisation. It would clearly cause workplace health and safety issues and psychosocial issues as well. So I think there is a reasonable balance to strike between trying to get the very best out of the organisation and to not be fearful about talking about issues where we feel like operations can be improved. But that balance has to be struck against those issues that we've raised. I do think that the, I guess, mandatory education components of this are useful. At first, I kind of bristled at the idea of them. But I think the more that we reflect on our role as councillors and where we sit, we can find a happier balance, I think, than what we've struck in the recent past. Thank you.
Thank you. Any further contributions? I'll just make a brief comment in relation to it because it was just mentioned in passing by Councillor Cordova. I just wanted to highlight the mandatory mandating of council learning and development. So I have been involved for the last couple of years with the Local Government Association Learning and Development Framework, and we've been working with the Office of Local Government on the production of the training modules that councillors have been asked to undertake. And as we know now, and as you'll see from our draft annual report that's on tonight's agenda, we're now obliged as a council to report against them so that the community can be aware of which councillors are undertaking ongoing professional learning so that we can understand fully and the contemporary climate in which we operate. And as part of this suite of reforms, it is suggested that incoming councillors be obliged, or sorry, candidates who wish to stand, that they will be required to give an undertaking to complete the those learning and development modules within a specific period of time of being elected. I think that is very, very important. I know that that did create some discussion about whether it should be prior to standing for election, and I guess I would probably urge anyone who's considering doing that to look into whether they can access those, because I think it gives you those modules give you a significant overview of the demands of the roles that are very, very different from 20 or 30 years ago, given the climates that we operate in. So I'm pleased to see that. I'm also pleased to see the introduction of temporary advisors for councils. What that actually means is that we've had situations in councils around the state where, unfortunately, their government's procedures haven't been fully met in the past, and as a last resort, the only option that the government has had available to it under the current legislation is to dismiss the council and put in an administrator. That is very disruptive. It means a lack of a loss temporarily of community input because there are no then elected representatives, and the ability for the minister now to, if this passes, to appoint a temporary advisor to assist a council is a step prior to that drastic one of sacking a council, and it has been used successfully in a lot of other jurisdictions where it can be someone who comes in and provides assistance and mentoring, if you like, to improve the practices and processes. So I think there's a lot of positive things in this targeted reform bill, and happy to support the submission that we will be putting in. Councillor Fox.
I guess I agree with the document. I think it's something I support, but I note that there is a response from Council relating to development mandatory Council learning and development obligations, and I think it is very important that consideration should be applied to training accessibility and it can be delivered to those with either technological limitations or those with different learning challenges. And the last line particularly, noting that it is via separate legislative review, that pre-election information should not diminish democratic principles of supporting diversity of thought. And I think that's critical because we are not employees, we are representing the community, and the community is made up of people with divergent opinions, challenges, physical and technological, and it's important that we don't have a sort of monoculture on council, but we have got those people out in the community represented on council. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Fox. Any further contributions? Councillor Gladewright, would you like to sum up? No, I'll put the recommendation moved by Councillor Gladewright and seconded by Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye. Aye.
Against? The motion is carried unanimously. Takes us now to page 71, Project Delivery Review, with a recommendation on page 74. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Cordova. And a seconder? Councillor Fox. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. So Council is essentially recutting this is the project delivery review. So yep. We're noting the findings of the independent report. I jumped the gun there a bit. Look, there's been a lot of community consternation around this and there's a lot of community interest, and I'm pleased to see that where there are concerns about council performance, that we have the honesty and transparency to seek a second opinion or seek an independent review to constantly be improving our operations. I note the particular areas that I found disappointing, but also I think there's learnings that can be reflected, and they're very clear in the report, is around the interaction with other agencies, particularly TAS Networks and TAS Water. I think that this is a really helpful review and I found it very interesting to read. I did have one question around, I guess just around the timing. The report was... Can somebody please just take me through the steps that we go through from the commissioning of the report being concluded in sometime in September and then it making its way here? Has there been an internal process already of looking at it and learning from it, or what was the kind of delay that resulted in it getting here in November, not September?
Yep. CEO can assist us with that.
So following the receipt of the final version of the reviews, there's been multiple things that have happened. One is the internal review and going through it in detail. And as is alluded to within the paper, there's a number of these things that are already in action as improvement actions. So the engineering department are undertaking a number of things at the moment to improve how we deliver our capital program and budget and capital delivery of projects. The second thing is this was workshopped with councillors. So we took councillors through the full reviews to talk through the detail in here, make sure that you understood the context here and were able to ask any questions that you had about these reviews, and then it's come through to appear on your agenda today.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. And so through you, Mayor, am I correct that there were two revisions of the report, and those revisions looked like what? I mean, what got lost and what got included? And maybe talk us through why there are revisions necessary.
CEO.
After receiving the first draft of the reports, we thought they were potentially a little bit underdone. They didn't necessarily go to the full depth that we would like. They didn't have the level of rigour that we had hoped that they might have. They weren't honestly as critical of us as we had hoped they would be. And I say hoped in so much as the purpose for doing this is to learn from it. The purpose of doing this is to be as honest as we possibly can with ourselves about where we need to improve, and we didn't feel like they necessarily had that level of detail in the first cut. The second cut was more finessing pieces of information that weren't quite factually accurate. So there's always a process with these types of things where you go backwards and forwards just with addressing some of the minor detail before you receive the final report.
Thank you.
Councillor Cordova.
Thank you. Through you, Mayor. It's so important that we own the parts of this for which we were responsible, and I'm really pleased to hear the way in which the CEO is discussing that, and I wholeheartedly agree that, you know, and that's why this is such a valuable experience. Obviously, you know, it's regrettable that it got to the stage where we needed that intervention, but obviously, you know, all we can do is try to do better. But my interest now is, obviously, it's clear within the report what our processes need to be to change, but my interest is now also in how do we engage with those other agencies, TAS Networks and TAS Water. What's their reaction to this report, if any, and what's that discussion looking like at the moment to kind of, I guess, make those relationships more seamless so there's not the kind of delays that we saw.
Mr. Mackey.
thank you. I think in terms of the other agencies, it's about our diligence up front. So we got informal approvals, in particular talking about TAS Water, but what we didn't do was actually get that completely signed off at that stage of the project. So we've got to improve our rigour at the front end of the project to make sure that we've actually dotted the I's and crossed the T's before moving into that delivery phase. As part of our new project initiation briefs that we're developing, and we're implementing those now, we've got a gated framework to make sure that all of those elements are signed off before moving into the next phase of the project.
Further questions? Councillor Fox.
I do appreciate these reports. I think they're very helpful, and I understand it's a complex issue relating with various agencies and then getting that all worked out well before the process starts on a job, and we need to do that better. But I'm wondering also whether there is an element that we haven't really talked about in detail, in that we have limited budgets and limited number of staff. And in order to deliver these large projects, particularly when they're involving other agencies, and I'm wondering whether we should be including comments along that line about future projects, that we should perhaps have more staff to deal with them, or more time to be able to deal with them. Are those something we should be considering ahead of the project rather than once we've landed a project?
Mr. Mackey.
Thank you. I think for me it's about it's the project planning phase and understanding the size and complexity of the project, and that should determine the appropriate amount of resourcing to go to those projects. And again, if you look at the reports here, we probably didn't do the appropriate amount of project planning, and which then we end up doing a project off the side of a desk, and the project manager ends up being a one-stop shop for everything. So again, as part of that gated framework, we need to, before it moves into the next phase, we need to make sure we understand the risks, the complexity, the stakeholders, and assure that the projects are appropriately resourced. Yeah. Thank you.
Councillor Dean.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, just a couple of quick comments, but no questions. Just a big thank you to the CEO for undertaking this work and for what you've pointed out is going back and actually making sure that these were very robust. Councillor Cordova is absolutely right. There's been a lot of interest in these projects, specifically obviously helped by a few media articles that pop out. I'd like to see them cover this and take, maybe get out the fact that we are owning this and we are looking to make things better. I doubt they will, but you never know. You can always hope. And the fact that we're putting these out in full, I think, is an important step and one to be commended for. Not that I read many other council agendas, but I don't imagine there's too many councils doing what we've done in this, and I'd like to think that this is a really good step and one that we'll learn from, and it's very, very good. So I really hope that people out there will read it and we do move forward and able to avoid similar situations in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Dean. Further comments? Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I've got some questions.
And I'm asking these questions because I don't think they've been asked previous by anyone in any of the workshops. We did do a workshop to discuss this, and there have been a number of people from the community that have asked me to follow up. So I do not ask these questions with any malice, nor do I know of the names of any individuals. And I note that both the CEO came and arrived pretty much at the tail end of this project, and the Director of Engineering well after it was all over. My first question is around the project manager feedback. Did we have the same individual or different individuals on the two projects?
CEO.
The project manager for both of these projects was consistent. However, the delivery of projects doesn't just rely on a project manager. It's a complex environment that relies on many people across an organisation, and as it was identified in the reports, in cases that project manager was left isolated and as a single person, focal point, and that is unacceptable in the delivery of these sort of complex projects. So I don't put the responsibility of some of the issues here on the project manager.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, noted. Is the said project manager still in our employ?
CEO.
Look, thanks for the question. Look, I'm not going to go into detail of individual employment status around this. I think Council has done our duty in terms of reviewing the work and the learnings that came from these two projects. We deliver projects in multiple locations, many projects across the municipal area. In this case, we have picked two where we have done the sort of review and work, and we will take the learnings from these and look to use them to improve the delivery right across the organisation. But I won't go any further in terms of talking about individual staff as part of this process.
Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. Noting that I don't know who any of the individuals are, so I'm not asking these questions for any personal malice or vendetta. I think the community has the right to know whether or not the individual is still managing projects for us or that person doesn't work anymore.
Councillor Dean, on a point of order.
I'm just wondering, given the workplace health and safety regulations that we have, whether we should be going down this path of trying to, you know, pursue individuals given the nature of the report that we're discussing.
And I feel like we are going down a slippery slope here of what I was hoping this would not turn out to be. This is not meant to be a witch hunt of any particular staff member. This is meant to be a review of the whole of our practices and processes across the whole of council. This was not trying to identify blame on one individual, and I would uphold your point of order that, Councillor Antoli, you are getting close to turning this into something that it shouldn't be. So could I just urge you to express some caution? I'd ask you to have some caution around your questioning, please.
Thank you, Mayor. So I'm completely ambivalent as to what the issue is. I'm asking questions about a function, not about a person's name. And I think given the trial that it put the community through, the fact that I've been asked this multiple times to find out answers to this question, and I've never asked it before, nor have I heard it asked or answered previously, I'm within my rights to ask it. The witch hunt is not after, I'm not actually asking for the person to be sacked or anything. I would just like to know, is the individual still running projects for us? It's really that simple.
The CEO.
I think that question has been asked and answered, and so much as I'm not going to go into any further detail around the employment situation for any staff in this organisation.
All right.
Councillor Antoli.
I'll move on to the next one. With regards to cost overruns, there's no mention about what ended up being the cost overruns for either of the two projects. Can we be advised on where that ended up?
The CEO.
I think it has been reported in the media, and it has been in for the bus interchange, it cost us $70,000 to undertake the work at the bus interchange, and it has been in financial reports previously, albeit in the capital report, so it's a bit buried around Summerlees Road. So that was $284,000 at Summerlees Road.
Councillor Antoli.
Great. Okay, thank you. My final question is around the PMO recommendation from the report, which I thoroughly agree with, and I've actually mentioned that at audit panel meetings as well. What's the leadership team's plan on setting up a PMO that supports the leadership team expertise in these areas?
Mr. Mackey.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, we're doing, as we talked about in the workshop, we've had an independent review end-to-end of our total processes. As part of that and reading the recommendations for this report, we'll be setting up a PMO-type function. Our ability to actually set that up structurally might be a challenge due to resourcings, and we're kind of in that awkward size at the moment. We don't really warrant a full PMO, but the intent of the PMO will be taken on board and incorporated into our project governance framework.
Councillor Antoli.
And do we have the budget at hand to resource that PMO? Is that going to be an extra request?
Mr. Mackey.
Thank you. We are still currently working through the process mapping on that, and we'll determine a recommendation to take back to the CEO.
Okay.
Councillor Antoli, anything further?
Thank you.
Further?
That's all from me.
Anything further from anyone else? Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. I wanted to congratulate the CEO on commissioning this report, and also the Director of Engineering Services on his response to this report. I just wanted to, ask a question around some quick wins. So sometimes with these things, there are some process things that can be put in place that will significantly improve outcomes at low costs. And I just wonder if you could outline if any of those things have been identified and what they might be.
Mr. Mackey.
Thank you. As just previously mentioned, one of the things in terms of quick wins is the development of the project initiation brief, which is significantly more comprehensive than what we had in place historically, and it essentially walks the project manager through the development of any capital application and ensures that we're checking off, we understand the stakeholders, the risks, we've got an adequate project plan, we've identified all the appropriate actions and the appropriate approvals are in place before the project entering into the capital delivery phase. So that's probably the core quick win we've got at the moment. We'll continue to assess for other quick wins as we progress the process development, but substantially we look to be rolling out the process in the new year.
Councillor Richardson, anything further? No. Anything further from anyone else? Councillor Cordova, did you want to sum up? No. Thank you. I'll put the recommendation then, moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us now to page 106, audit panel appointment with a recommendation on the following page, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Fox. Seconded, the Deputy Mayor. Councillor Fox.
I have worked with Mr. Paul Viney, and I think he is very sound and very experienced and is involved around the state in different audit panels, so I think he brings great value to our audit panel, and I recommend him for the position.
Thank you. Further contributions, Councillor Antoli.
Thank you, Mayor. I've had the pleasure of working with Mr. Viney for the past 12 months on the panel, and I think he adds great, robust gravitas to the panel. I'm also happy to recommend his reappointment.
Thank you very much. Any further discussion? No need to sum up then. Thank you, Councillor Fox. I'll put the recommendation moved by Councillor Fox and seconded by the Deputy Mayor. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Takes us to page 108, annual report for 2024-25 with a recommendation on the same page, and I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved, Councillor Cordova. Seconded, Deputy Mayor. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. Very pleased to see the annual report. So much good stuff in here, and as I probably say nearly every year, I'm always really impressed by the broad scope of the works that Council undertakes. I mean, you can see on page 157 of my agendas, this is page 47 of the annual report. Just take a look at some of the just within engineering services that I'm looking at all those photos of the infrastructure that's been developed or renewed or refreshed or upgraded. It's always heartening to see. I was trying to kind of figure out, over the 6 years I've been on council, I would say it's probably around $18 million a year, something like that, in terms of the infrastructure investment. So we're looking at more than $100 million worth of, you know, fixing things and putting in new things and making things nicer and more livable, improving amenity. And $100 million over 6 years is, yeah, it's pretty impressive. I was kind of just looking over that. But also the Natural Areas Biodiversity Team, the amazing things that are being undertaken there, the Land Care Group and the thousands of trees that are that are being planted, and the community public open space areas that are being enhanced, the weed management and feral cat eradication that we talked about. All of these long-term investments, it's something, I guess, why I bang on about a street tree strategy so much, is that when you plant a tree, over the course of those 20 and 30 and 50 years, you're seeing this asset grow. And there are, you know, playgrounds in our municipality, public amenities, public bathrooms that are there now that weren't there when I was growing up. And it's these little bits and pieces of infrastructure and public open space and street art and furniture and things that just make our lives just a little bit easier. And we see them all, and maybe we take them for granted when we walk past every day, but it is actually what makes this community so popular. I mean, so many people want to move here because we have great stuff, and we've got a great team of people working to improve our amenity. I'm so grateful to the staff for the work that they do. And yeah, if ever you feel, I guess, upset or frustrated by various individual aspects of council operations, just think on how broad this organisation is, how it's a major employer in the community, and yeah, take a look at page 47 and just see all the bits and pieces in your life where, yeah, council's been building and improving and maintaining and fixing and monitoring, and whether it's from the school inoculation programs, whether it's the whether it's our parks and gardens, or whether it's our beachfront, our local area traffic management, the breadth and the scope is really impressive. And I guess the annual report, in a way, apart from the important governance role that it plays, it's also a bit of a celebration of that. So thank you once again.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further discussion? I'll just add briefly, thank you for summing up the annual report, because I think it's not everyone's favourite bedtime reading, but I would encourage people in the community to have a look at it, because it does show the huge breadth of activities of council and does demonstrate that we're not about roads, rates and rubbish, that there is, I guess, a structure that we work within. We have obviously a lot of legislative responsibilities that we have to carry out. But we also do so many additional things within our community, perhaps things that people don't even realise that council actually is responsible for. So I would encourage you to read it and perhaps then come along to the annual general meeting on the Saturday, the 6th of December, where you would have an opportunity to ask questions about the annual report, and we certainly would welcome that. So thank you finally to the staff who have contributed significantly to putting this together. It's a big job, in particular Mrs. Morton, who spends months gathering all the information from the directors and other staff and producing such a lovely looking document that also showcases some beautiful pictures of Kingborough. So appreciate that, and certainly we look forward to releasing this very shortly. Councillor Cordova, I'm guessing you don't want to sum up. Thank you very much. I'll put the recommendation, moved by Councillor Cordova and seconded by Councillor Gladright. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against, motion is carried. Takes us to page 274, financial report for October 2025, with a recommendation on page 276. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. I haven't got Councillor Bain here tonight. Somebody else will have to do the heavy lifting. Councillor Richardson. And seconded Councillor Fox. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. Yes, missing Councillor Bain on this one, so I'm sure he's listening in.
So just a quick run through. Statutory fines are over budget by about 250 grand. User fees are up by about 150 grand. Grant income is up by nearly 400. We've got reimbursements which are over budget by only 50, and then other income is 71 grand over budget. Then we come down to the expenditures, and we've got a series of under budgets, including employee costs, but obviously that'll just be time variances. Materials and services are under budget. There's some other expenses that are over budget, and then some depreciation is under budget. This puts us in a position of being having a $1.13 million favourable result, which is fantastic. And I just wanted to, ask a question to the CFO. Is this position likely to hold, or are there other things that are coming up that that may change this position?
Mr. Spinks.
Thank you. It's certainly too early to know whether the very large favourable variance at the moment is going to hold. What we have done so far is made positive adjustments to the tune of, it's about $340,000. So we came into the year forecasting an underlying loss of just a fraction over $2.5 million. That forecast is now just a fraction under $2.2 million. There's a number of variances remaining. A lot of those are timing. I don't expect those to be permanent by year end, but we'll just have to continue to monitor. But so far, things are looking pretty good.
Great. Councillor Richardson.
Thank you. That's all for me.
Anything further? No. I'll put the recommendation then. Moved by Councillor Richardson, seconded by Councillor Fox. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried unanimously. Takes us to page 290, appendices. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Moved Deputy Mayor, seconded Councillor Cordova. Any questions on the appendices? No. Okay, thank you very much. I'll put the recommendation. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. There were no notices of motion, and then we're on page 290. Confirmation of items to be dealt with in closed session, confirmation of minutes and applications for leave of absence. Looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Got a mover in Councillor Fox, seconder Councillor Cordova. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. In accordance with the Council Meetings and Councillor Workshops Audio Recording Guidelines Policy, recording of the open session of the meeting will now cease. Thank you very much. Our members of the public gallery have all left us. Appreciated them being here. To those who have been watching along at home, thank you very much and good evening, because the open session of the meeting will now cease at 7:07 p.m.